No, no, she came to us in person. She was at a fundraising event for a pregnancy center. But she did hand out the DVD. She was actually here last night. With her daughter. Her daughter is 4 now.
You ready?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. We're going to go ahead and get started. It's my pleasure to introduce James Bopp. Juris?
J.D.
Doctor. He's an attorney. General counsel for the National Right to Life Committee. Is a member of the Bopp Law Firm who, with practice emphasis on not-for-profit corporate and tax law, campaign finance, and election law, the biomedical issues of abortion, foregoing and withdrawing life-sustaining medical treatment, and assisted suicide, federal and state trial and appellate litigation, and United States Supreme Court practice. He has litigated extensively on these subjects, including arguing 6 cases before the United States Supreme Court. Mr. Bopp has testified before the numerous congressional committees and has published dozens of popular and law review articles on pro-life and First Amendment topics. Mr. Bopp currently is vice chairman of the Republican National Committee and is a commissioner of the National Conference of Commissioners of Uniform State Laws. He previously served on the National Commission for UNESCO, on the President's Committee on Mental Retardation, on the Congressional Biomedical Ethics Advisory Committee, and on the National Institutes of Health Fetal Tissue Transplant Research Panel. He's also general counsel for the James Madison Center for Free Speech. He resides in Terre Haute, Indiana with his wife, Christine. They have 3 grown daughters. Welcome, James Bopp.
Thank you all very much. I assume all of you have gotten the handout that we have at the chair and also in front. And I will be referring to that later, so don't look at it now. I'm going to give you a preview of what it all means and try to put it all into context for you. Now, of course, the Right to Life movement, and as really all movements, are organized into groups. And we have local, state, and federal Right to Life, or national Right to Life groups. And these organizations are all not-for-profit, and they therefore are subject to Internal Revenue Service requirements for not-for-profit organizations that vary depending upon the type of not-for-profit organization that is involved. And of course, what we are involved in is attempting to primarily, not exclusively, to influence public policy by changing governmental policy through the adoption of legislation, the action of executive officers, the action of the courts, so that our public policies will be adopted by government. Now, when you look at what these organizations can do in terms of the law, there's really 2 different sources. Look at these as 2 different filters, one on top of the other. They're really independent of each other, but each of the filter you have to go through in order to conduct your activity in a lawful way. The first filter is what the Internal Revenue Service allows each organization to do. And as you will soon see, the IRS is trying to focus people into developing various structures that emphasize certain specific activities. So the first thing that you think about when you want to do a particular subject is which organization, which entity, which structure within your organization is the one that both legally can and would be the safest to conduct the activity. The second thing you do, the second filter, is campaign finance. Because under the rubric of campaign finance, the state governments, in regulating state campaigns for office, that is for state offices, and Congress, in terms of people running for federal office, they regulate those campaigns, and under that rubric, they have extended their regulation quite, in some cases, quite widely to affect what you would otherwise think to be, lobbying somebody like your legislature, or just simply talking to the public about the issues that you're concerned about. So each of these filters you must, go through, first the IRS, which entity is the proper entity to conduct this activity as far as the IRS is concerned, then what is the implications of the state or federal campaign finance, and does that direct you to a certain entity or require you to file a report or have a disclaimer or comply with other types of regulations? I will talk second about the Federal Election Campaign Act and analogously the state campaign finance laws for the types of issues that you need to look at. But my primary thing here is to work on the first filter, that is the Internal Revenue Service, and how their regulations mean what structures can do what things, and then how, as a result, we have set up our Right to Life organizations to take the best advantage of the opportunities and the requirements that the IRS imposes. Well, for any advocacy group, movement that wants to influence public policy, there's really three critical elements, each of which you need to do robustly and effectively if you're going to influence what the government is doing. The first is education. That is educating the general public, educating legislators, educating opinion makers about the particular subject involved. Obviously, as in a democracy, as people understand and support your issue across the board, you're much more likely to get that instituted as a public policy. The second is lobbying, and there's two types here. There's direct lobbying, that is going to a specific legislator and saying, please, vote for or against a particular bill. That's what we call direct lobbying. The second type is grassroots lobbying, and that's when you talk to the general public and ask them to lobby their legislator about a specific legislation that may be pending. So lobbying can be two types, direct or grassroots. And the final is political intervention. This is influencing elections, usually directly by either contributing to a candidate, advocating the election or defeat of a candidate, or the IRS, you will soon see, has a very broad definition of political intervention that involves many factors you're supposed to look at. But in any event, these are your campaign and election-related activities. So the three critical elements, education, lobbying, and political intervention, it's obviously much easier to lobby somebody if they already agree with you because you've got them elected. It's a lot easier to get your public policy adopted if they've been the legislator or the decision maker has been educated and knows what it is and agrees with you in terms of what you you want to accomplish. So each of these are critical, vital. If you don't do each of these effectively in a robust way, you're really handicapped in your ability to influence public policy in America. Well, there are three principal entities that are not-for-profit entities that are involved in advocacy activities. All three of these are tax-exempt. That is, they pay no corporate income tax on their income. So they have tax advantages that also mean that they are subject to regulations on what they can do. And each of these have different characteristics, both what their purposes are and also what requirements apply to them. Let's start with a C3. C3, and of course this is Section 501(c)(3) of the Internal Revenue Code. Many people have heard of this. This is what we would call a charity. And that's your local hospital or the Catholic Church or local soup kitchen. There's a lot of charities, the art museum. There's a lot of charities and the local university. These are all 501c3 organizations. The benefit to being a C3 is that when a donor contributes to that organization, the contribution is tax deductible so that they can take it off their income tax. That's a big advantage. And as a result, as you will soon see, this entity is also the most limited entity in what it can do. The second type is a C4, again, a 501c4. This is a lobby group or an advocacy group. This is usually the central entity of any movement, and such as the National Right to Life Committee is a C4. The Sierra Club, NARAL, etc., are all C4 advocacy groups. We talk about them as advocacy or lobby groups because that's the main thing they do. But as you will soon see, it's the most flexible entity, and that's why it's usually the central organization. The final one is a 527. This is a recent innovation at the Internal Revenue Code, and this is what is called a political organization. When this was adopted in the 40s, the concern was that the IRS was thinking about taxing politicians' campaign accounts. You know, when they're running for office, they get contributions to run for office, and since those entities didn't fall under C4 or C3 or some of the other exempt organizations like trade associations, well, then the IRS was starting to think, well, this is a taxable entity. And of course, politicians will always pass laws to benefit themselves. So you can be sure to that. So they ran, you know, they hurried right up and adopted Section 527, which provides that political organizations are tax exempt, stopping the IRS from taxing their campaigns. At the beginning, these 527 organizations were candidate committees, political action committees, political parties. The traditional political actors were considered to be political organizations. Over time, this has become a larger bucket of entities because the IRS, as I've already mentioned, has expanded what political intervention means very widely. Now it encompasses entities that are not federal PACs, that are not or state PACs, that are not candidates, that are not political parties. And I call those issue advocacy 527s. And we pioneered that in 2000, that entity, as an entity that was influencing elections but was not a PAC. But in any event, so the three main entities for tax purposes are 501c3 charity, 501c4 lobby group or advocacy group, and a 527 political organization. So what can these groups do among these activities that are important for advocacy groups to be able to do and to effectively influence public policy? Okay, so education. Can a C3 educate? Yes. This, as I mentioned, the university is a charity, a C3. That's a classic example of the activities C3s can do. How about a C4? Well, yes, C4s, as part of their activity, can educate all they want. They could actually spend all their money on education, but they wouldn't get a tax deduction because they're not a C3. But as an activity, they could certainly do education. How about a 527? Can they educate? Well, yes, but it has to be insubstantial. Now, this is a word you're going to soon hear several times. And insubstantial means, as far as the IRS is concerned, is say 5 to 15% of your gross expenditures in the year, depending upon the facts and circumstances. Well, you'll hear the IRS say that all the time. You know, their tests are facts and circumstances tests. Well, I'm not sure what else they would be looking at. Astrological signs or, I mean, you know, what would they look at other than the facts and circumstances of what happened? So that actually tells you absolutely nothing about what they consider, other than they consider something that's at least in the real world. This has to be insubstantial, 5 to 15%. Well, how about lobbying? Can C3 do lobbying? Well, yes, they can, but it has to be insubstantial. Again, this 5 to 15%. How about a C4? Well, yes, of course, this is a raison d'etre for a C4. They can spend 100% of their money on grassroots and direct lobbying. How about a 527? Yes, but again, it has to be insubstantial. And finally, how about political intervention, influencing elections? Can a C3 do it? No. No political intervention by a C3. If a C3 does political intervention, it will be either subject to a tax at the highest corporate rate and or will have its tax exemption revoked. It's actually rare to have tax exemptions revoked, but it's a threat. All right, how about a C4? Can they involve themselves in politics, political intervention? Yes, they can. But again, it has to be insubstantial. So as far as the IRS is concerned, the IRS, a C4 organization, can contribute to a candidate, can advocate the election or defeat of a candidate. Now, obviously, as I've already told you, this is, as you would all immediately recognize, just because the IRS says it's okay doesn't mean that the campaign finance laws either say it's okay, or if they say it's okay, it won't have other requirements that apply to it. So that's a good example right away that you know of two filters. Can a C4 do it? As far as the IRS is concerned, yes. But will campaign finance laws allow it? Right. And then how about political intervention by 527? Well, of course, that's the raison d'etre for that organization. So if you take a look at this, what you see is that the IRS is trying to concentrate certain activities into certain entities. Or you could say, you know, the C3 is doing education or charitable activities. C4 is doing education and lobby activities. The 527 is doing political intervention activities. As far as the IRS is concerned, if the entity goes outside of these principal activities, then they're going to be scrutinized, whether it's insubstantial. No, you can't do it, as far as the C3 is concerned. So they are encouraging you to set up multi-entity structures in order to take first full benefit of the advantages, like tax deductibility, but concentrating those activities in different structures, which is the safest and the most effective way to conduct the activity. Now, the other thing about a 527 I should mention is in 2000, because of the rise of these issue advocacy 527s that were not reporting as federal PACs, either by state or local or federal campaign finance regulations, Congress decided to require 527s to report all of their contributors over $200, all their expenditures, so that they report to the IRS. If they're not reporting already to a state or federal campaign finance reporting system, then they have to report to the IRS just as if they're a federal PAC. So as far as donors are concerned, these two entities do not report their donors except to the confidentially to the IRS, except when an IRS employee unlawfully leaks, like they did the National Organization for Marriage's tax exempt list of contributors. Except when that happens and the bureaucrats, you know, decide to punish organizations by violating the law and leaking these two organizations do not publicly report their donors, but this one does report their donors. As we all know, donor reporting discourages political activity, discourages you to associate with any entity, particularly if it's at all controversial. And the reason is that the politicians that you're opposing, or their supporters in government, or their supporters in private supporters are very likely to do something to you, to punish you, to harass you, to discourage you from doing this. So there's always a legitimate fear of that, and as a result, disclosure discourages people from associating with groups. And of course, that's one of the reasons why politicians want any groups that might oppose them to disclose, because they know that will discourage that from happening. So you can see concentration of activities. Now, what that leads you to is how we've organized right-to-life groups. What we do is that we have one corporation. That's the corporation right there, and it's a C4. So it's an advocacy group, the most flexible entity, remember? It can do everything. It can educate, it can lobby, it can intervene politically. It's the only one with that sort of flexibility that also shields donors from disclosure. So they can do everything, and so that is the most logical central organization for a movement. Now that therefore has your board of directors, your board, then it has your officers, and then it has your staff. Yeah, they're all in here, in your C4 corporation. Now, however, obviously looking at this, you if you want to take advantage of tax deductibility, you need a C3, because there are some donors who will give you more if they get a C3 deduction, or may not give it to you at all unless you do. And of course, you can do useful things with it, educating. And also, you're going to need one or more 527s in order to participate in elections. You'll need a federal PAC if you want to do federal elections. You'll need a state PAC if you want to do state elections. So you got to have those structures too. So what you do is you put them right in here. They are in the corporation. Right? You have your C3. You have your 527, which may be, let's say it's a federal PAC. These are just bank accounts. From a corporate structure standpoint or a management standpoint, these are just bank accounts. This corporation has three bank accounts. It has a C4, a C3, and a 527. And when the executive director decides, we're going to contribute to a candidate, the only decision he has to make is which bank account does it come out of. We're going to pay for a billboard campaign that urges people to support a particular bill. Which account? We're going to write the check out of. Well, probably be the C4 account in that case. We're going to urge people to understand that abortion takes a human life, and that we should love them both. Well, that can come out of your C3 bank account. So you have three bank accounts. It's all controlled by the same board, same officers, same staff. The only decision that they have to make when they spend the money is which checking account do I write the check out of? That's it. Now, so it's very simple to manage. Because you only have one management structure, and as far as the IRS is concerned, these are still three separate entities. Each of them files a 990. Well, these two file a 990. This one is reporting either to the IRS or to some as a PAC somewhere, to the feds or the state. And each of them are considered to be, for those purposes, tax purposes and campaign finance purposes, different organizations from each other. But they're all controlled by the same one. Still, 30 years after the IRS has approved this, we still have lawyers saying if you're going to have a C3, you have to have a different board from your C4. You may have to have them, differently incorporated or whatever. All that is completely untrue. They can be in one organization all at the same time, all happy together. And the IRS is perfectly happy with that. Now, how can the money flow? In other words, let's say that you have extra money here and you want to do education that the C3 was thinking about paying for, but they don't have the money. Or you've got more political activity that you want to do and you don't have enough money in that account. All right? Can you move money back and forth within this structure? Yes, but only one way. That way. In other words, from the more benign from the more controversial, if you will, from the political to the lobbying to the charity, you can move money that way because, as you could see, these entities can do those things. You cannot move it that way except under very limited circumstances. In other words, you can move it this way if the C4 does. Let's say the C4 pays for the billboard. That is an educational activity. The one that I talked about that the C3 could pay for. What happens if the C4 pays for it? But then you get money into the C3, and C3 can write a check to the C4 for that specific activity. You know, $5,683 for the billboard campaign. All right, and you write that check to the C4. The second way is, remember, you have your staff here. The staff needs to be all in the C4, and what you can do is a time study on the staff and see how much educational activity they do. Let's say 20% of the time they're working on educational things. Well, then you can allocate 20% of the staff costs, including overhead, rent and all that, and the C3 can write the C4 check every month for that 20% of what the C4 pays for. Now, obviously, in terms of your fundraising, I mean, having these structures affect your fundraising too, because you've got to anticipate how much money you need in each entity, and then direct your fundraising to get the money together in that entity in time for you to do what you want to do in that entity. So that's certainly true with the 527. The only way to get money into that is to raise it from contributors, and because you can't really transfer it from any other entity. So you've got to raise the money there. You've got to think of a budget, and of course, National Right to Life gets as much money as they possibly can because they have unlimited opportunities to spend it. And so they usually look at what they need in here and here, and then focus all the rest of their fundraising here. Now, so it does require you to do some advanced planning as far as raising money is concerned, in order to get the money in the place that you want. It is also most beneficial to get the most money in the C4 as possible. You know, if the money is in the C3, its use is restricted, right? It can only be used for educational activity. Well, but if it was in the C4, it could still be used for educational activity. It just means that there's no restrictions on using it for lobbying. So you concentrate your fundraising in the C4. And certainly, all of your low-dollar fundraising should all be done into the C4. Or when you have elections coming up and you need certain amounts in your PACs, then, of course, you do fundraising for your PACs. But the concentration should be in the C4. It's the most flexible use. Let's say you go to somebody who's always helped you, and you want to pitch them on the C4. This is where we can do everything here, except for direct political activity. Usually, we can do everything here, and he says, I could give you, I suppose, $5,000 for your C4, but I really could give, you know, another $5,000 if it was a C3, it was a tax deductible. You say, fine, no problem. You just make it out to our foundation, that extra $5,000 to our foundation. We'll take the check, we'll put it in there. You get what you want. We've raised the most money that we can, all right? So fundraising needs to concentrate here, but you have to do advanced planning. So that's the way we set them up. Obviously, this requires some maintenance, and that's why the national is set up this way. That's why we set up the state organizations this way. Not a lot of local chapters have the wherewithal to do the legal compliance and the accounting compliance work. Some certainly do, but others don't. And then what that means is you set up a C4 as your local organization. You may not have the benefit of having a PAC or a C3, but your state organization has a C3. So if you went to somebody and said, hey, we want to do a booth at the fair, it's all educational, would you give us X amount for it? And he says, well, you know, I'd like to, but I got to have a C3 deduction. Well, then you talk to your state organization. Everyone that I know of would say, well, yeah, fine, no problem. You have them write the check to our C3. We'll write the check for your fair booth, and it'll be no problem. So you can take advantage of your state organization in, if you don't, on a local level, have a C3. The final big subject is with respect to the IRS, is this. You can see how the IRS is focusing activities, but you can also see that the difference here between lobbying and political intervention has some big consequences. First, a C3 can't do it and jeopardizes their tax-exempt status. Second, a C4, while they can do it, it has to be insubstantial. If it's not, they pay tax. And if they do too much of it, they're actually a 527, and then they've not been reporting to the IRS like they should have. All their contributors and all their expenditures and all that. So what is the difference between lobbying and political intervention is a big issue because it has big consequences. Now, this is where I want to explain first the way that campaign finance deals with this, because in campaign finance, you can sue these state laws or federal laws directly. You know, if you're wanting to do something and you look at a state law that seems to mean that you can't do it or you're going to be regulated in some undesirable way, you can sue it if you think that it's a violation of the First Amendment. And if the courts find it is, they'll strike it down. But in terms of the IRS, you just can't sue the IRS. The only way that you can sue the IRS is if they assess a tax against you, you pay the tax, then ask for a refund and wait 6 months. And if they don't refund the refund, does not give you the refund, then you can sue them in court. Well, you know, that's a very difficult process, and as I will soon explain, the other part of it is that the IRS is really big on making threats, but they're really shy about getting dragged into court. So even though I've tried on a number of occasions to get them into court, it's been extremely difficult to do that, because what they want to do is bully you, but they don't want to be held into account. So they will move heaven and earth to prevent you at the very last minute from getting them in court, while all the rest of the time they will be threatening you up one side and down the other. It's really disgusting. Despicable, and other things, I'm sure. Well, so this line, what is this line? Let's start with campaign finance, all right? Okay, campaign finance, we're talking about federal, all right? Many of these same concepts you will find in your state laws applying to state elections, meaning elections for state office, governor, attorney general, state legislature. And federal, of course, is Congress, the Senate, the president. But many of these same concepts you'll find in state laws. And if you're talking about state officials or state candidates, you have to look to state campaign finance law to go through that second filter. Campaign finance, this line is pretty clear. All right, it has just really three elements. One is a contribution. If you give money to a candidate, that is political activity regulated by federal and state campaign finance laws. It may be subject to contribution limits. There's about 20 states that have no contribution limits. The rest of them do. The federal is $2,500 per election per candidate. So the most you can give for an election cycle to somebody, one person running for president, is $5,000. Your wife could do, you know, give a similar one of $5,000. But for contributions, corporations and labor unions are prohibited from making contributions. Now, PACs and political parties also raise money and can give to candidates. PACs limit is $5,000 per election to a candidate. So political intervention one is contributions. Now, that could be direct, which I was just talking about, giving money. It could be in-kind. And there's really two kinds of in-kind. One is, rather than give them money, you just hand them the laptop. All right, that has a value. Whatever the value of that laptop, current fair market value, that is how much that contribution is. Or you might give them a list. That has value. You know, $70 per thousand, whatever it might be, $100 per thousand, it has value, depending upon the type of list that it is. Those are in-kind contributions. Another kind is a coordinated expenditure. In other words, you want to go out and do buy an ad in the newspaper. And you want to, by doing that, you want to endorse a candidate and tell people why you think that candidate ought to be elected. If you don't talk to the candidate about that, it's an independent expenditure, which is the third kind, second kind here in a minute. And the but if you coordinate that with the candidate, in other words, you take the ad and go to the candidate and say, well, you know, see, here's the ad I want to run. What do you think about this? And he says, well, you know, I like it that you're mentioning this issue, but I'd rather not mention this other issue because most people really don't agree with that here, and I'm trying to focus my campaign on other issues, and would you mind, you know, changing that to reflect an issue that I'm more interested in or whatever. So you're kind of negotiating what that advertising has in it. Well, that means you're coordinated with the candidate, and that makes it a contribution. Meaning that it's just like if he would, you'd go to him and say, I want to give you $2,500, and he said, well, I'd rather you pay this bill. Here's this bill for this printing. You know, you want to write a check to this vendor? And, well, that's a contribution to the campaign. You're paying a bill of a candidate. Same idea. The activity has now really become the activity of a candidate because of the coordination activity that you have. The second type is an independent expenditure. This is where you expressly advocate the election or defeat of a clearly identified candidate. That is, you expressly advocate the election or defeat of a clearly identified candidate. You can see certain elements in there. One, it has to be express. You have to use certain words or terms that mean to vote for or defeat. So you have to say vote for, vote against, defeat, support, oppose the election of. You have to use words that mean vote for or vote against a particular candidate. And you have to name the candidate. It has to be perfectly clear that there's one candidate in mind that you're talking about and that that person is clearly identified. Now, you could use his picture. You know, you don't have to use his name. You could use his picture, you know. Or you could say the President of the United States. There's only one, all right? But so if you expressly advocate the election or defeat of a clearly identified candidate and you do so independently In other words, no coordination. You don't talk to the candidate about it. That is called an independent expenditure. And you can spend all the money you want on independent expenditures. And in fact, now, as a result of cases I've won, including Citizens United, you can create a super PAC that only does independent expenditures, only does not contribute to candidates, is a federal political action committee, fully regulated, but the normal $5,000 contribution limit to the PAC is waived. It can also accept unlimited contributions from corporations or labor unions. So what we have seen is the super PACs, because they only do independent expenditures, have no contribution limits as opposed to everybody else. Political parties, PACs that give money to candidates all have contribution limits, not a super PAC. What that has meant now is that super PACs, and it's a wonderful development, super PACs will have leveled the playing field for us, for Republicans and conservatives. They will spend as much money as the candidates do, if it wasn't for super PACs, looking at the presidential election, the amount of money that Obama would have raised and spent, that the labor unions would have raised and spent, and that the mainstream media would have used in promoting Obama, would have been way in excess of what would have supported Republicans. Super PACs have leveled that playing field. They're right now 4-1 in terms of money raised for Republicans versus one, four times the amount for Republicans than for Democrats. Wonderful innovation. Now, the third type of expenditure is what's called an electioneering communication. EC, we call them, this an IE. Anyway, EC is an electioneering communication. What that means is a broadcast ad, not print, not newspaper, not brochure, broadcast ad, 30 days before a primary and 60 days before a general election, that mentions the name of a candidate. All you have to do is mention the name of a candidate. There's no other content requirement. It doesn't matter what you say about the candidate. Like you might say, candidate Joe Blow died, would you come to his funeral? That's an electioneering communication. It doesn't matter what you say as long as you say the name of a candidate on the ballot, all right, within 30 days. So originally, before Citizens United, corporations were prohibited from contributing, and labor unions. Corporations and labor unions were prohibited from doing independent expenditures, and corporations and labor unions were prohibited from doing electioneering communications. After Citizens United, corporations and labor unions can do independent expenditures and electioneering communications, but they have to file reports. That are event-driven report, a one-time, corporation, Right to Life Group X, bought a newspaper ad that cost $500. You just report that ad and that $500 and any contribution that is attributable to that. It's a one-time report. It's not reporting every month or every quarter like PACs have to. And of course, PACs have to report everything they do, not just this one newspaper ad, right? Corporations and labor unions can do independent expenditures and can do electioneering communications, where they are prohibited before Citizens United. They are still prohibited from making direct or in-kind contributions to candidates, even though I'm trying to do something about that. So, I think the logic of Citizens United is that they should be allowed to do that, again, subject to limits. There are contribution limits in most instances. There is no limit on independent expenditures. There is no limit on ECs. You can spend all you can raise. And so you can raise the most if you set up a super PAC, and because you have no contribution limits, and then you can spend everything you raise. Right? So these are pretty clear, all right? I mean, an EC is actually quite clear. It's you a clearly identified candidate, we know what that is. We know what a broadcast is, ad is. The essential elements are obvious. Because the courts have enforced a bright line express advocacy test, we know what an independent expenditure is. I'm not saying they haven't tried to breach these and tried to expand them. They've been doing this forever, all right? They're always trying to do that, and we keep suing them and knocking them back. But the but this is clear, and this is clear, and this is pretty clear, actually, now, because even though the concept of a coordinated expenditure sounds a little fuzzy to you, there are actually some pretty good rules on what that means. And that has also been the result of of litigation, of suing them and making them use rules that people can understand in advance. Now, so that's the good news about campaign finance, all right? I'm going to tell you the bad news about the IRS, then I'm going to answer whatever questions you have. Now, now what about the IRS, the original filter we started with? What's the difference between political intervention and lobbying? Heck if I know, because the IRS will not tell you in advance. And they're quite proud of this. They have insisted upon, as I mentioned before, a facts and circumstances test. They look at the facts, they look at the circumstances, and then decide whether or not it influences an election. It is true they don't look at your horoscope, they look at the facts and circumstance, whatever that means. And there's no way to know in advance what that means. What they have, and now they've given further advice by issuing two revenue rulings. These are things that are official proclamations of the IRS that they are saying that they will follow in administering, the Internal Revenue Code. There's two of them, Revenue Ruling 2004-6 and Revenue Ruling 2007-41. These two have adopted factors that they will consider on whether or not something is political intervention. Factors. In the first revenue ruling in 2004, there were six factors that would indicate it's political intervention. And there were five factors that indicates it's not political intervention. But what they didn't tell you is how many of each you have to have, or whether X amount of one cancels out how many you have of the other, or whether or not just one is sufficient either way, because of the heavy weight that they place on it. In other words, they've given us 11 factors and not told us how we can possibly employ them. Now, they complicated it further in the 2007 revenue ruling, because there, as opposed to identifying 11 factors, they identified 8 factors. 4 of the 11 disappeared, and they added another one. But here, for the first time, they've told us one of the factors is important, and you are particularly at risk if you meet this factor. That factor is if the communication refers to voting or an election. Now the problem is that factor, identified in 2007 as the most important one, was not even mentioned in 2004 as a factor. So you tell me how to apply this, okay, and implement it. Well, it means that people who can afford it have to hire people that have a lot of experience in looking at, things and thinking about what the IRS and looking at how the IRS in audits or informal letters that they send out and all that are applying these rules and make a judgment determination. But the other thing that it tells you is, look, you better use these entities. In other words, should a C3 do lobbying? Let me tell you one of the factors. The communication identifies a candidate's position on a public policy issue. Well, that's what you do when you lobby. You do lobbying, right? You say, there's a vote coming up in Congress, and it'll have taxpayer funding of abortion. We oppose it. We want you to contact your senators, Joe Blow and Mary Smith, and urge them to vote against this bill. Well, that if you say Joe Blow and Mary Smith are pro-life and said they'll support this, and tell them to make sure to do that, or you say Joe Blow and Mary Smith has supported taxpayer funding of abortion, so they need to be lobbied to change their mind on this. You're doing a lobbying communication, you think, but the IRS thinks you're trying to influence an election. So things that you think are quintessentially lobbying are also reviewed by the IRS as political intervention. One of the factors is you target voters in a particular election. Well, you're lobbying a congressman. Who do you target when you're lobbying a congressman? Well, his or her constituents. Well, they also are his or her voters. So you think you're targeting the people that this congressman will listen to if they lobby him. The IRS thinks you're targeting the voters in this election. So when I say an identical lobbying piece that you think is all about grassroots lobbying, the IRS could very well identify as political intervention. So is there any difference then between these two? Not really, is there? So what does that mean to you from a practical standpoint? Don't do your lobbying in the C3, do it in the C4. Okay? It's not that they can't do it, it's just imprudent, dangerous to do it. So by setting up these structures and concentrating your activities where the IRS wants you to, and the biggest one is lobbying versus political intervention. Lobbying here, political intervention here. If you concentrate, them in those places, then you can say you're 100% safe, because the areas of vagueness and dispute has now been placed in a place where there's no real big consequences. It's the safest place for you to do it. You won't lose your tax exempt status. Now, in order to avoid being moved from here to here, because you're concentrating all your lobbying here, and they may think some of it is political intervention, I say keep your political intervention, this political intervention, at no more than 30%. And even though this is vague, this line is vague, and the IRS may come in and say, well, some of this is actually here, down here, you still won't get to 51%, which then pushes you over here. Okay? All right. Well, that's the good news and bad news. For all the reasons we have, I've suggested here, this works really, really well in giving you all the flexibility and all the benefits of having these various structures. From a management standpoint, it is very workable as a way of setting up an organization, and it provides the greatest safety to you. So I'm pleased to answer questions you may have. Yes.